Rosa Ritchie from RMIT. I've recently moved from Wurundjeri to Ngunnawal country.
And I'm Blake Dennelsark from the University of Canberra on Ngunnawal country. Welcome to Making a Difference, a Junction Journalism podcast produced by journalism students from universities around Australia. Coming up on the program, a story on how to help victims of revenge porn. And we'll start a conversation about a condition affecting almost a million Australian women.
One thing we've learned from the pandemic is how vital sport and physical activity is for our mental health. Months went by when sport was cancelled and gyms were closed. Even a bike ride had to be done in small numbers. But it's been so much worse for older people, who were told to stay at home and avoid mixing with others. University of Canberra reporter Eamon Moore spoke to some older people about the importance of being physically and socially active.
It's early Tuesday morning, and for the first time in months, the AIS Fitness Centre Aqua Aerobics class is back, following a mandatory centre closure. Many of the regulars of this class are over the age of 65, and statistically are the most vulnerable people in the COVID-19 pandemic. However, participants returned in droves this morning to join in the group class. AIS Centre Manager Deb Acklin says that it is the social aspect that draws these vulnerable people out of isolation.
Certainly the social implications that they are coming for. And I would say that over the physical workout is most important to them. Some of them come every day, some of them come three times a day.
Wow.
I know.
Deb informed me of some regulars who faced a difficult decision in deciding whether or not to come back to the centre after the closure. I called Bronwyn, a longtime patron of the fitness centre, to hear how she battled with isolation and even begged her doctor to let her return to the pool.
I'll tell you, my granddaughter's a doctor and she didn't want us going back even to the pool, but I said to her, I'm going mad. I've got to go back somewhere.
Yeah. What benefits do you think you got out of going to these classes and returning? Is it just the physical side, or do you think there's a mental and social aspect?
Mental as well. Mental as well, definitely. Yeah, both. Yeah, most of the friends I've made since I've been retired have been through Aqua. Yeah.
Yeah, I was feeling isolated, and towards the end I was feeling... especially when they rang me and said I could come back. Helen said, you know, a friend of mine, she said, I'm going back. And my doctor said no when I rang him. But then by the end of the week, I thought, no, I've got to do something. I was getting depressed. You know, I actually was walking one day around the back here at Dunlop, and I started to cry and I just couldn't stop, you know, and I was just feeling very, very lonely and very isolated.
I spoke to geriatrician Dr. Marianne Cool, who told me Bronwyn's experience of isolation and depression is common amongst elderly people who are longing to return to their usual activity.
I've actually seen people because they've become so withdrawn from their usual exercise regime, get more depressed and get more anxious.
Dr. Cool says that a generational gap leaves elderly people less able to engage when interactions are dependent on social media.
Generally, technology is a bit foreign, and you know, most of their social groups are done face-to-face.
For those elderly Canberrans like Bronwyn who are stuck in isolation, Dr. Cool says enjoying exercise and reconnecting is worth the risk.
I think the benefits of doing the exercise far outweigh the risks.
Eamon's story there reminded us of how important socialising is for everyone. It also showed us how determined older people are to have a purpose in their lives. And that makes some of the debate during the pandemic about older people a little jarring. Some might even say offensive. As we went into lockdown, a number of politicians and commentators were lining up to complain about the restrictions. It's bad for the economy, they would say. Some argued the restrictions should be loosened, and if the virus spread to the vulnerable, then so be it. Yet every day we're reminded of the value of older people, particularly when they do so much of the volunteering work in this country. One of those people is Hilton Harmer, OAM. The 81-year-old retired Salvation Army officer told University of Technology Sydney reporter Dylan Crismally that he's still got a lot to give.
What do you do for your community, Hilton?
We assist with food and clothing and at times furniture, but on a regular basis it's food every week. And we focus on three main groups, really. We focus on asylum seekers and refugees and people who live in down market boarding houses. And we have an outreach into the centre of the CBD with our fruit and veggies each week.
And why do you do what you do?
Well, none of our clients are ever Bible bashed or preached at, but we do what we do because the words of Jesus, when he said, like, I was hungry and you fed me, and I was naked and you clothed me, and I was thirsty and you gave me a drink, etc., etc., etc. We like to think as Christians, we're practicing Christians, and that is not just going along to church and singing songs and saying prayers, but by actually putting our Christian faith into practice. But the other thing, of course, is the reason we do it, because the need is there. We have the capacity to meet the need, so we put our time and our effort into it, and it brings a tremendous amount of enjoyment to us.
And what are your thoughts on when politicians or figures in the media say, you know, let's get everything back to normal, things along the line of, for the good of the economy, it's okay if a certain percentage of, you know, older people die?
I've heard those statements. We should have let it just go. And so what if we lose a few of 70, 80, 90-year-olds? You know, I've heard them say it. It doesn't affect me, doesn't offend me. I think they have it in their mind, old people who are all crippled up with arthritis or have some other injury or sickness, and they sort of sit around in the nursing home all day long or sit at home all day long. I think that's what they have in their mind. They wouldn't surely have in their mind people who are actively out in the community helping. There are thousands of senior people who help in the community and use the experience of their life to enhance the life of other people. So it doesn't worry me. I think it's a statement that's not thought through, put it that way.
How does it make you feel when you see the faces of the people that you've helped?
Oh, a tremendous amount of joy. I've been brought up in a way that I had everything I needed. I was brought out of hospital and taken home to a garage with a dirt floor. That's how poor our family was. And I don't remember, but I was only a baby. And my cot was a banana crate. And my father was out of work. It was during the Depression. I was born in 39. So I just rejoice in my heart that I've been able to help with one of the basic needs of life, and that is food. And another one that follows closely behind that is friendship. I mean, these people are in a strange country. We're a different colour than they are. We speak a different language. The international language is a smile, and people know when someone has compassion towards them, and so I feel overjoyed about it. And then they send me a text when they get home, when they unload the goods or something like that. No, it just gives you a feeling of well-being, and I'm tremendously thankful to God that I, at 81 years of age, I can do this, so much of this work in the community.
That was retired Salvation Army officer Hilton Harmer speaking with Dylan Crismally. Now, while we're on things that we've learned during COVID, let's talk about equality. Lockdown sent everyone home, and we had to rely on technology and the internet to work, learn, and socialise. But that assumed everyone had access to the necessary devices and connections. And even in a wealthy country such as Australia, that assumption is wrong. It was particularly difficult for school kids whose families can't afford all the modern trappings of life that many of us take for granted. RMIT reporter Lauren Bastow has this story on how schools and families tried to make it work.
When you don't have a device, let alone an internet connection, your ability to do certain schoolwork can be hindered. majority of my classes, they require a device for research and possibly other classes that get hosted and everything like that.
If a pandemic comes along and school has to move online, this becomes even more relevant. That was the case for Jack, which isn't his real name, just to give him a bit of privacy. But he's a Victorian school student from a low SES background. And going into remote learning, he already had some obstacles in his way.
I was using my phone as much as I could. It was the only device I really had, so.
To help students like Jack, the Victorian government announced in April they would loan out more than 6,000 laptops and tablets to help ensure access to remote learning, and schools would loan out ones they already had. Education Minister James Molino said,
"Every child that needs a laptop or a tablet will receive one."
According to Steve Warner, the principal of a public school in Melbourne's West, there was a delay in getting the devices.
You know, I was frustrated by how slow they were getting stuff out and how we had to, you know, identify 20 kids who got the first lot, then we are able to identify 50 kids and so on. So it became a priority list rather than just being able to treat everyone equally.
He says he understands part of this would have been due to the number of people trying to access devices at the same time.
I don't know how many kids there are in Victoria, but let's say 50,000. So how do you get that many devices in one hit, given every family who's also financially well off would have been purchasing equipment at the same time?
Eventually, students received them. Jack, who qualifies for the Camps, Sports and Excursions Fund, was given one from the Department of Education. He said it made a difference.
The classes were posted on a dock or on a Google Classroom, and it was just easier to access everything on the laptop than it would be your mobile phone. Like, everything, like every program or every like website is just like better on a laptop, so like, you know, it's just much easier to use for some things and like stuff like that.
But while having a device helps, there's still another resource you need for online learning.
I don't have availability to internet every day.
And again, that's why the state government committed to providing some internet dongles to students. But just like the devices, there was a delay. So Mr. Warner and his school took it into their own hands.
We were told that we would get them. They were so slow in coming initially that that's when we went out and got them. We took our higher need kids and we prioritised those students that were actively trying to get assistance from us.
Over the two periods of remote learning, they purchased a number of dongles.
As a school, we purchased, I don't know how many, probably 50 to 80 different dongles at different times, and we got in a couple of hundred as well from the department, so they sent them in.
For students like Jack, this internet meant they could actually access online school.
Actually allowed me to access the classes when I needed them in the mornings or any time of the day, so it was just helpful in every way.
Mr. Warner and a number of staff made sure students had the resources they needed.
There were a few teachers in the school that dropped off stuff to people's houses.
The laptops ensured a lot of students could keep learning.
They allowed a number of, the majority of students who got one to keep learning, even though it may have been less learning than they would do in a face-to-face, they still managed to achieve something.
And those laptops from the department aren't actually going anywhere.
We've been instructed to not get them back, so the students who got those actually still have them.
Jack is a student who gets to keep his laptop, and he didn't know this when I spoke to him, but he told me about how it's still been useful after remote learning, especially because he's doing a vet certificate.
We have this thing called iVet we do, and then like every couple of weeks or so we have to like do this new task and like stuff like that, and all of it's online, so can't do it like on paper or anything like that, so it helps a lot with vet work and everything like that.
Mr. Warner says his students will benefit even further because from next year, every student from year 7 to 12 will require a device, and that's how they'll access their textbooks.
We're doing it because we want students to be able to have that flexibility. If they are working from home, they can do so. We're doing it because while a device might cost $1,000, say if it's the 3-year life of a device, you would spend more than $1,000 buying textbooks. So that return on the device, as well as the opportunity of your research and other presenting materials, emailing teachers and so on.
Here's a fun fact. Humans are now sharing 1.8 billion photos on social media every day. But the constant newsfeed of happy, shiny images can make some people self-conscious about their appearance. 60% of Australian women suffer from body image issues, and from there, it can spiral to depression, anxiety, or eating disorders. Reporter Emma Thompson from the University of Canberra spoke with 19-year-old Michaela. She says the stream of perfect images on social media made it difficult to just go clothes shopping without comparing her body to others. Now Michaela is speaking out to help others feel more comfortable in their own skin.
Are people around you affected by negative body image? So do any of your friends or family experience similar things to you?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I have a lot of close female friends and they all have different issues. And it's really interesting to see the diversity of negative body image, because one of my friends is considerably leaner and skinnier than I am, but she's got her own insecurities. She doesn't like the way her collarbones pop out and other things that I would go, I'd trade for that in a heartbeat. Like, her problems seem way less than mine because I've got this undesirable body type, but she's got things that are considered undesirable as well. So it's really hard to see girls around me that I go, hey, you look beautiful and I think you look gorgeous, and they go, no, I'm struggling just like you. And they have their own set of issues because no one can achieve that perfect body type. And, you know, my mum and my sister as well, because they've always been told by media, whatever it is, all those outside influences. And they're like me. They've got the same genetics as me. They can't achieve that skinny body type because we're curvy.
So looking into your experience with body image, why do you think you were affected by it? Where did your concerns come from?
I think for me personally, I was an avid reader growing up. And so seeing women, lead women who are meant to be considered socially desirable, whether by traits or by image, it was really hard to go, I can't aspire to be that because she's skinny and she's fit and she's beautiful. But I want all those other things too, like her bravery and her leadership and all those other things that I went, she's an awesome role model. But she was presented in a body type. It's like the packaging she came in for all those other things that I wanted. I went, well, I have to get through that first because that's what people are going to see first. And so I think that's why I struggled with it, going, these are all the women I want to aspire to be like, whether it was in books or movies or any kind of media. If I saw them as a role model, I'd go, but I don't look like that. So how can I possibly be all those other things?
And that's just such a huge part of the issue. The media just plays this massive role in body image issues in women. How do you think we can start combating against that?
I just think the best time to encourage girls to be more than just the sum of their parts is when they're so little. Because if we don't help define our daughters who they are, someone else is going to do it for them. And so the best example I've seen of that is a good friend of mine. She gets her daughter to make I am statements to her every night before they go to bed. And so instead of saying, I am pretty, she says, you are amazing, you are smart. And her daughter repeats and goes, I am amazing, I am smart. And yes, she does say, I am beautiful, but it's not an aesthetic, it's I'm gorgeous. And so we need to define our girls before the world defines them for them. That's what I'd say.
You're listening to Making a Difference, a Junction Journalism podcast. It doesn't seem so long ago that Australia was gripped by crippling drought. Towns and cities almost ran out of water as parts of the country went years without decent rain. It was yet another reminder that the driest continent on Earth has to find enduring sources of water as the climate gets warmer. But ways to secure the country's water is also presenting other challenges. RMIT reporter Fraser Douglas explains.
Right now, I could go to my tap and get a litre of water without batting an eye. Despite living in the world's driest continent, water is always readily available in the big cities of Australia. Australia currently has an over-reliance on surface water, with 81% of water used by Australians in 2018 to 2019 sourced from it. This over-reliance was recognised by Infrastructure Australia's 2019 report into the nation's water, which recommended easing the over-reliance by opening up more water desalination plants. The federal government has previously considered these plants as a way for cities to ease their reliance on surface water, with Perth opening their first back in 2006. Today, each metropolitan city has at least one of these plants, but the amount of carbon dioxide that is currently produced by these plants to treat water may be hindering the development of more. In a 2019 article on the carbon footprint of desalination, contributed to by professors from the University of Sydney, one conclusion they came to was that much of the carbon footprint of the desalination process came from electricity consumption. Even though the desalination process doesn't produce a lot of carbon waste, it does require a large amount of electricity to make salt water drinkable. Therefore, it is down the supply chain at electricity plants where the vast majority of carbon dioxide is emitted. If Australia's desalination plants fail to utilise green energy, they would be contributing to the biggest threat to future generations of Australians.
Is unequivocal evidence of climate change.
It also says
and that the record high temperatures
in climate change would in a dramatic report from the UN's intergovernmental panel. The report says the world is nowhere.
According to Infrastructure Australia's report, global warming is the biggest threat to the nation's water. The continent is already susceptible to droughts, but as the global temperatures rise, surface water will dry up. Desalination is an option that would allow our finite water supplies to be managed more sustainably. But with global temperatures rising, more needs to be done to ensure that desalination is conducted with minimising our contribution to climate change in mind.
While Fraser's story showed us that Australia has some challenges on water security, we're not alone. Yemen in the Middle East is a nation ravaged by a humanitarian crisis. 24 million people are in desperate need of food and water, 12 million of them are children. So, right now, demanding action on climate change is not a priority. But as Yusuf Saudi from RMIT found out, young people in Yemen are finding a way to ensure it remains on the country's agenda.
While climate change is an issue spanning across Australia, we've got to remember that it's around the world impacting developing countries. We've seen how Swedish activist Greta Thunberg has helped shape the climate movement last year through global protests like the school strike for climate change.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school.
But not every country has been able to do this and be as outspoken. Activists can be imprisoned or get killed if they went on the streets advocating about the climate crisis, while some people don't even know if it exists. This is the Middle East. Tariq Hassan is a youth activist in Yemen. He says climate change has affected his country in many ways.
There's a lot of friends has been, their house has been destroyed because of the rainfall happens now in the last 2 months in Yemen.
Yemen is going through the world's largest humanitarian crisis, as well as trying to come to grips with COVID-19. Since the Arab Spring in the early 2010s, Yemen is in both civil war and undergoing conflict with Saudi Arabia. Internal and external fighting has left two-thirds of Yemeni people hungry, according to the UN World Food Programme. The country also has one of the world's highest rates of child malnutrition. Tariq Hassan is the chairman of International Youth Council Yemen, head of the Arab Youth Sustainable Network, and a part of the UN Environment Programme. He speaks with me from his place in Cairo, Egypt, because he cannot be in his home country, Yemen.
People actually don't understand the real meaning of climate change. And this is the big issue that we are the role models. We are the role models on helping the people to understand the effect of climate change. Yemen has been very impacted to climate change, especially this year, actually, you know.
The country, like many, have suffered weather extremes. Yemen has endured drought in its desert-like climate, And when torrential rain and flash floods hit the country earlier this year, they washed away parched soil, destroying the homes of about 300,000 people. Mr. Hassan says climate change is rarely discussed in a country that has to be focused on its humanitarian crisis.
They have some priorities because of humanitarian situations. They have like a humanitarian activities is more important than talking about climate change, because people are searching for food to eat and water to drink only. They are not thinking about doing climate change activities and climate change activism.
Attempting to go on the streets and demanding climate action is also something that can result in someone being jailed or killed. But Mr. Hassan is demanding change, and he wants the country's youth to be a part of the solution.
There is no a youth who really knows and play a key role in climate activism in Yemen. So basically, I'm the only person from the youth who attending like COPs, Convention of, you know, the climate change conference. And I do negotiate with the government's delegates about the role of civil societies and the role of young people to contribute to climate change.
Mr. Hassan says there's another way to get the country's leaders to understand the impact of climate change on Yemen.
I believe in youth, seriously. I believe in youth, and I believe in their abilities to be a change makers in the MENA region.
Yemen is one of the most vulnerable countries in the Middle East. Young people mightn't have the luxury of heading to the streets and protesting for change, but they're finding ways to take on climate action that is suitable for their country. There is hope in the youth of Yemen.
Listening to Making a Difference, a Junction Journalism podcast. Here we are in 2020, and yet another football season has gone by with players being subjected to racist taunts. It doesn't matter which code, it's still happening. And racism in sport is not confined to the elite level. Jackson Clark is a Larrakia man from Darwin and a reporter and commentator on Northern Territory football. He also plays AFL. He told RMIT reporter Matt Parnell that he's determined to change attitudes at the local level as well.
Well, myself got racially abused. We were playing a game at in the WRFL, Western Region Football League, and I got called a dirty coon twice, and then that went to mediation and everything. I had five people from my team heard it. Two people went through and come as witnesses and said the exact same story, which is the exact same story that I said and the exact same story that a neutral said. The guy got 8 weeks, but at the end of that, I'd found out, I didn't know at the time, but I'd found out that there was 3, 4, 5, maybe even more footballers from our team that had heard the comment but didn't want to go through the, and that's their choice. I'm not saying they're racist people, but they didn't want to go to the effort to go to tribunal and put their case in. So I think, you know, when that got back to our existing Indigenous players at the club, they kind of felt like they were sort of left behind a little bit.
Do you see any kind of, like, development pathway to stop this being such an issue, or do you think it's kind of just ingrained at this juncture?
No, I think it's just ingrained, and not so much a football club culture. I think it's just the young bloke culture. I think the exact same issues, like that exact same issue I told you, I think would be the exact same issue if... you know, a young Indigenous guy from Darwin moved to a workplace in Victoria and had, you know, staff meetings and workplace culture and vibes and stuff like that. I think you'd get the same jokes, the same air of awkwardness, and that's mainly just caused by the society that we live in 2020. So, for example, the racial abuse case that I dealt with, I was in a tough position, right? So I felt that with... I thought there was going to be a strong chance, because I went to mediation and the guy didn't deny it. He didn't deny it, but he didn't admit it. So we basically were reached a stalemate in mediation, and I thought that that there was a chance that the guy would be off because it was my word and a couple of witnesses, but not that many, against him. And I just didn't know. So I was half going through my mind whether to publicly write something on my football page, which has a sort of decent following, and I was just going to write something along just the truth. I was going to write the story of what happened and basically said, so if you're an Indigenous footballer, I'd stay away from this football club. You know, the whole, it's systematic racism throughout the whole club. I think that the WRFL and the governing bodies and those that are required to do education. I think the state league clubs, I think, I know there's controversy with Lumumba at the moment, but I hand over heart genuinely believe all AFL clubs, all 18 AFL clubs, just from what I've seen, are pretty educated these days. It's getting better. And yeah, pretty much that. I do think that most of the good clubs, I know good's a broad term, but I think most of the state league clubs, AFL clubs, really, you know, country clubs with a good culture, I think they are providing environments that are very inclusive and, you know, they've got a bit of education surrounding how to best deal with Indigenous players. And for that answer to how to best deal with Indigenous players, for 90% of them, is treat them like everyone else. And then there's probably 10%, those that come from communities or are moving away from house or have a few little difficulties and challenges. That's just an education process to learn. I think that it's getting better and better every year because they are making an actual effort into educating themselves. I think any football club that, you know, that doesn't put any effort whatsoever into Indigenous relations, or not even that, multicultural relations, talking to people with differences, you know, and that's women's footy as well. I think anyone that doesn't put time and effort into that are probably naturally just going to go backwards. I think that work is being done, yes, but it's not across the board or systematically. It's sort of mainly at the top.
That was Northern Territory footballer and reporter Jackson Clark, and that wraps up the program. For more stories about making a difference, go to our website, junctionjournalism.com. I'm Blake Denelsa.
Thanks to the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas, the Journalism Education and Research Association of Australia, and the Constructive Institute in Denmark for making the program possible. The program was produced by the University of Canberra on Ngunnawal Country. I'm Rosa Ritchie. Thanks for listening.